Welcome back to episode 133 of Chess Journeys, Tales of Adult Improvement. Here on Chess Journeys, we love seeking after the glories of ratings gain, but we also like diving into the plateaus, which are the norm, and sometimes the pits of despair below that. If you want to support the show, you go to Patreon Chess Journeys, and I want to thank our Queen level supporters, Blundergoat, Tim Everett, Scott D4B6Joe, Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Dan Rich Burgess, Brandon Hallside, Jeff Peterson, Tobias Rex, Bob Berger, Nicholas Harrigan, Rich Bradley Fenner, Fletcher Ray, Nathan Peterson, Christian Glaw, and King level supporter, Ian Samples. If you want to appear on the show, well, fill out the Google form in the show notes. We all want to hear your story. You can also DM me on Twitter. That's a great way to let me know. And if you're interested in getting better at chess, and I feel like we all are, you could use Noel Studer's Next Level Training Program. There is a code in the show notes below. It gives you a discount. It gives me a little help for supporting the show. Everyone wins. All right, let's bring in our guest today. We have Neil Bruce. He is one of the founding members of the Chess Punks, creator of the Chess Punks Awards, habit master, and murderer of chess books everywhere. Neil, welcome to the show. And have you had a chance to play any chess yet today?
Kevin, it's always a pleasure to talk chess with you. I did play a couple blitz games. I got a draw and a win, so I'll take that. And yeah, I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to the conversation. It's been a while since I've been on a chess podcast. I kind of stopped accepting invitations because I got sick of listening to myself on these podcasts, but it's been 18 months and I'm over that. So I'm ready to talk again.
Okay, good. Because I've definitely asked you a few times in that time and you're always like, don't worry, I will, just not yet. And I'm going to be honest, for a little while, I was like, oh, Neil's going to, he's ghosting me now? What's going on here?
But no, turns out that wasn't the problem. I was ghosting everyone, if it makes you feel any better.
Okay, no problem. And I can understand the hearing your own voice. Like, I like to listen to my guests' suggestions again later. And then this annoying person, Kevin, talks. And I'm like, dude, just stop talking. Just only listen to the guests. So I hear you. Okay, I think the place to start is to talk about sort of your journey since we last spoke. I believe you weren't back to like regular over the board yet. You were still just kind of like in your cocoon, studying, going through your plan. So what's it been like to come back to over the board chess, and have your results been what you hoped they would be when you got back?
Yeah, so it's been amazing. My club, local chess club, it's called Metro West Chess. It's about 30 minutes from my house. They finally reopened after COVID. They opened in July of last year. I've been playing every single month. A huge advantage for me lately is I've been working from home. I work for a software company based out of Baltimore, and I have to travel occasionally, but I basically was for years and years working in Boston and having like a 1 hour commute either way, which that's all gone. And now my youngest just went to university in the fall. So I have all these extra hours in my day that I didn't used to have. So it's been wonderful. And I've been taking advantage of that. So my chess club reopened in July. They have a weekly Wednesday night game. I tend to post my results, win, lose, draw on Twitter, just to keep people informed on how I'm doing. When I came back in to rated games, I was rated in the low 1700s. I'm now rated in the low 1800s. My official USCF rating right now is 1829. So I jumped about 100 points in about 6 months, which was surprising to me. But I've been really enjoying it. And what's changed for me is I'd done several years of basic tactics, and then in a very sequential way, I did about three and a half years of strategy work while COVID was happening, pre my club reopening. And now, because I have this extra time, I can do more than one thing at a time. So I'm working on really three things at once, because I've got kind of three times as much time available to me than I used to have without having kids in the house and having no commute for most days. So I'm working on intermediate tactics and visualization, kind of calculation in general is one big thing. I'm finally also going after openings and end games at the same time. I'm planning on spending about 3 years on these three topics, and I'm doing a little bit of each most days. I was putting in, kind of when I started tracking my journey about 6-7 years ago, I was doing like 45 minutes a day, about roughly 7 hours a week. I'm now trying to do between 14 and 21 hours a week. Okay. Like I would say 14 is kind of my low and 21 mm-hmm. is kind of my ideal. Well, I know one of the questions on Twitter was around burnout. I'll talk about like how I never mind 14 feels like a light week for me. So I'll explain how that happens. But what I realized is a long time ago, if I'm only going to do like 45 minutes a day and I'm trying to learn, not just review, that's not enough time for me to do more than one thing. Like if I try to do 5 minutes of each thing mm-hmm. every day, I wouldn't like learn anything.
Yeah.
But if I have like a half hour to dive into something new that I'm learning, that's enough time, 30 minutes, an hour, that's enough time to actually like learn something. Mm-hmm. And so with me putting in typically kind of a couple hours of training a day, plus my games, you know, that's enough time for me to spend, you know, a half hour or an hour on each of my three topics.
Okay. A couple of follow-up questions in here. I'm going to start with the ratings. We're going to go back for a second.
Sure, sure.
You said you were kind of surprised you gained 100 rating points. I wasn't. I felt like, man, you put in so much time and effort. You feel like you're one of those kids that hasn't played in a while and shows up at the club and just crushes everyone. So were you kind of expecting to be able to do that? Or were you truly like surprised that you were underrated?
Well, you know, I look at ratings as really complicated because I could play one opening I don't know and play out of the opening like a 1200.
Yeah.
And so I think we really have like five or six ratings, you know, and it depends on which opening we're facing. And it depends on like lots of factors. So I think that if I get lucky and like it's an opening I know and it's a pawn structure I'm familiar with, or like it's an end game that I'm familiar with, like I can play like a 2300. Or if none of those are true, I could play like 1000. So I think that what I'm trying to do is close gaps. What's interesting to me about my club, and this is why I think so many people feel like it's so hard to get better as an adult, the players who were 2000, like a few years ago, are all now 1900. All the 1900s are 1800s, and the 1800s are 1700s. I'm really one of the only people who's an adult. Like the president of my club was like 1750 when I joined 14 years ago, and he's 1700 right now.
Yeah.
And he's been playing his whole life. So I think that there's what's typical, and then there's what's possible. Mm-hmm. And I know from talking to the guys who are kind of in their 40s or 50s or 60s that they're not putting in, you know, 14 to 21 hours a week. No. They're probably putting in like 2 or 3 hours if they're lucky a week. And what has happened for me from like just practically with my games is I'm close to kind of breaking even with the kids, the fast climbers, and I'm farming the adults.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's a practical strategy for adults is like, if you can just try to hold your own against the up and coming kids. Now the other thing that I think has really changed in the last say 5 years is people are way better at openings than they were 5 years ago. Way better in my experience. So is that your experience too?
Oh yeah. I mean, when I played, like I didn't play 5 years ago. When I played 20 years ago, I played the Nidor and I sort of knew some stuff, but like I just played and I was fine. Like I didn't get in trouble in the opening. Everything was fine. And that's like the sharpest, most theory driven opening in the world. And I just didn't feel compelled to know every single, I had like John Nunn's recommendation. And I learned that one line and there we go. I was ready to go.
Yeah. And so what I find with, especially this openings to me, I notice are a huge difference, adults versus kids. So the kids I play, and when I say kids, they're typically kind of like 8 to 18, usually more on the lower end of that. Mm-hmm. They tend to play offbeat lines. Like three of them are playing, you know, knight F3, one knight F3, you know, which I'd never seen, you know, until recently. You'll see gambits. I just faced the bishop opening, which I think I've never faced over the board once.
Okay.
And so they're playing stuff that's not mainline, like they're not playing a typical Sicilian or Rui or Italian. They're playing things that are a little offbeat, and I'm sure they're catching lots of the adults off, you know, kilter. And if it's like, so I had a game, I had two games in a row. They were the exact opposites. So I played a D3 Ruy Lopez's white instead of the traditional D4. And just to try something a little different, that I'm trying to work on that line. Mm-hmm. And it really threw off my adult opponent. And he blundered like two moves later, blundered a pawn. He just wasn't sure what to do. And he just blundered a pawn. And then like, he just kind of slowly collapsed over the course of the game. And I played this bishop's opening where I was like, do I go for C4 and then D5? Like, what do I do here? And I was under constant pressure from like move 2 to 23. And I was literally taking about 4 minutes a move trying to figure it out over the board. Right. And I looked at it with a computer afterwards, and for like 22 moves in a row, the computer said I was even roughly, but what was happening was, and I could tell I was slowly getting worse and worse. Yeah. And so the number of possible moves that keep me even were shrinking and shrinking, down to a point where there was an only move scenario. I did not find that only move. Mm-hmm. I had spent like, you know, 80 minutes, like a full concentration playing 20 moves, 4 minutes a move, which was like breaking my brain.
Yeah.
And I didn't find that move. And then like, it's over.
Right.
And so I think that this theory that I hear GMs and IMs talk about on Twitter all the time, that like opening theory is irrelevant, is just not true anymore. Like, I never really believed it was true, but it's so not true now. Like, you've got to learn a little bit about all openings, and to expect kids to play sidelines, to not play, you know, a typical Caro or a typical Italian or a typical, like, you know, I see some Londons from the kids, which makes sense because it's like a pretty straightforward system to get out of the opening. But I mean, Knight F3, I blame Nate Solon. I think his course is like working. So what's your experience with kind of offbeat stuff? Do you find that more with kids than adults?
Yeah, it's funny. I was about to disagree with you, and then I remembered, like, oh, right, that Forest kid at my club plays this super weird response to the Caro Kann. Another kid started playing like B3 or something just to mess with people. So I hadn't quite put that all together. But yeah, I think you're right. I think the kids are moving, or at least my small experience with them is moving more into weird sidelines, which kind of makes sense. Like, if they get booked up in the mainline Ruy Lopez, there's a very good chance all you're doing is matching your book to the other guy's book. If you get booked up in B3 or the bishop's opening or something that's still effective but kind of offbeat, your opponent, if nothing else, burns oodles of time just trying to figure it out, and then you've got a giant time advantage. And if nothing else, that should be relevant to some degree.
And what percent of the kids in your club, in your section, or sorry, what percent are kids and what percent are adults? Because for me, it's about 50-50.
Yeah. And my club, it's a weird section. So it's one big open section. Like, I was looking, and I'm so jealous of your club, where you get to be protected from the up and coming 12-year-old kids. At least you don't get to play the kids until they're already a reasonable rating. So I'm jealous there. But like, there's 3 really good kids, and there are like, there's 5 really good kids, and there's like 3 more that just got promoted into the adult section, and there's probably like 15 adults. So it's more adults than kids, but those kids are super scary because it's an open section. Like, the one kid I first played in when he was 1,000, and he was very good. And I was like, wait, what is happening right now? And the next time I played, he was like 1,300. And the next time he played, it was 1,500. This is only over a course of like 2 months. Right. It's just like, clearly he's been underrated, and now he's over 1,900. And I'm just kind of like, okay, these kids are very underrated.
Yeah, I have a kid I've played 3 times. I've won once and lost twice, and he went from 15. He's probably going to be 19 after this month. And so that's going to happen. It's really, it's really, to me, a tale of two types of people. Like, in general, there's the I'll call them average adult club player who I can't really relate to this, but I think they're just like, hey, it's fun, you know, yeah. And that's all Wednesday they're looking night, for. Yeah.
Get out,
hang out with your friends. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds great. I kind of wish I could be that person, Neil, that I just like, I don't even care. I'm just like, whatever. I'm at my floor. I'm having a great time.
Yeah. That's not me. I couldn't do that either. You know? And so, and I'm sure these kids just have like zero respect for these adults because they see them making these, you know, these chump moves when they don't know what they're doing, you know? I mean, I had a kid stand next to another kid right before our game started, and the kid I'm playing is like, oh, I'm definitely going to win. Maybe I draw. There's no way I lose. I mean, like, he says that right in front of me, like, to the other kid next to me. And I'm like, okay, like, you like the comments. I do, like, a couple more things on my club I find interesting is there were, before COVID, masters and guys up to like 2400 who would play in my club. All of them are gone. Some of them have kind of aged out. Yeah. I think that there were a couple of guys who were kind of around 2200. I think they've decided there's no benefit of them playing here because like the bulk of my group, which is the open section, is 1700. It's a ton of 1700s. Yeah. And so I'm now one of like the top five rated people in my club, which is crazy, Tom, because I joined the club. I was 1100 back when I was 40, you know, wow. So I've gone from 1100 to 1800, but I can see a path to get from, you know, 1829 to 1900. But like once I get to 1900, I think I'm going to have to start playing like weekend tournaments because you can win most of your games and lose points, you know, because you're playing people who are, you know, so much lower rated than you. It's like, it's a fun, I've never had this problem before. It's a good problem to have. It's like, it's a first world problem, but like, I don't know if you've ever run into that.
I don't run into that. I run into a weirder problem, which is very frustrating, which is like in my club, this tournament, I had to take a bye the first round. So I only get four rounds. I lost to a person rated 1900. They're better than me. They outplayed me. I accept that. I should have beaten this guy rated 1800. They're slightly higher rated than me. I let it get away. They beat me. Very upsetting. Whatever. So now if I win the other two games against lower rated players, it should about even out. But the problem is my first round opponent was 1100. It's just, you know, a little kid. It's great. He's playing. It's great. He's at our club. I really love having these kids join our club. But it's really hard because I'm going to beat the two people I should have beaten, theoretically, lose to the other two, and then lose like 40 rating points. And it's just like, USCF, like, what am I supposed to do here? If I lose the people I'm supposed to lose to and beat the ones I'm supposed to beat, shouldn't that be about even?
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, I want to get to a point where I'm closing gaps. And once I feel like I'm closing certain gaps and the three things I'm working on will help close those gaps, I feel like I will, my goal is to basically be really hard to beat. Like draws are fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I've noticed is, I think I got a little cocky and I like was on this tear of winning a bunch of my games last fall. And then like, I was like pressing too hard. The other thing I find fascinating is lots of people are offering draws way early. I don't know if they're tired. They want to go home, but like, I almost never accept a draw. And I've had games where frankly, I probably should have taken the draw, but I'm like, I'm trying to learn, you know, like I'm not going to learn with an early draw. And so it does help me in some ways to keep pressing. But I need to press, but also kind of always have that draw in my pocket, so to speak, and not press too hard. So I think that I've got to learn from that. I'm still like, since the club reopened, I've won more than I've lost. I'm still up, but you know, I've had some more losses recently, and so I need to think about like, how do I not press too hard? How do I close gaps? My attitude with openings has always been, you know, you can fool me once. Like if you play some line I don't know, then I'm going to lose and that's okay. But like, don't, you'll never do that to me again. So yeah. Like, I've been trying to figure out what to do against the bishop's opening. So when I face this kid again, I will not have to sweat it for 20 moves in a row, 4 minutes a move.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So Jay Garrison has a question for you sort of about your return, about studying versus playing. And he says that he's noticed that his anecdotal evidence has shown that playing is a big part of training for those that are getting better. So he's wondering how much of a role is playing in your program. Like, you talk about a lot of studying, you're studying these three things that we'll return to. You play once a week over the board. Do you play a lot at home online, or are you mostly studying?
It's a great question. And I didn't really try to do this, but I've basically like backed into Noel Suter's model of a third, a third, a third. That's what he recommends. Okay. And so the way that the math works, and this is in my ideal week, which is, I would say, most weeks, I'm doing, let's say it's 21 hours, simple math. So I'm doing an hour of play slash analyze, and most of that's playing a day. So I'm breaking it up. So like, what it works out is 7 hours a week of playing slash analyzing. What is that? So I have a 3 hour game, and then I analyze that. That's my Wednesday night. And then I play 2 5-5 games a day. Okay. And then I analyze those. And so that ends up being, you know, like, it ends up adding up to close to 7 hours a week I'm playing. And 2 is kind of my minimum. I'm often playing more than 2. That'll get me close to 7. And then I will, I'm planning, like, I try to do an hour a day of calculation, and I break that into different things. I can explain that more if you want. And then the other hour a day is either end games or openings, usually one or the other. And so I think that a lot of people say you got to go 50-50. I'm doing more like one third, two thirds. Okay. I think that it's, the thing I've learned is two things. One, having this over the board anchor item in my calendar is massively useful. And it gets to the question we got asked about motivation and burnout. Like, my whole week is centered around my Wednesday night over the board. That's kind of like, you know, that's my Thursday morning is my Monday. It's like it planned the whole week after that. And so that is incredibly motivating for me to get, I basically am like, okay, I got to get back into the arena a week from today. So like, yeah, maybe I take like half a day off, but I can't take more than that. The other thing I've recognized is if I want to get a real opening repertoire figured out, I've got to play like, you know, 14 to 25 blitz games a week in order to get the reps in order to, so it's almost like, you know, tactics flashcards help me get good at basic tactics. Well, blitzes is giving me the reps to test out my openings. I had no idea how little I knew. Like, I had never written anything down. I was just like, yeah, it's in my head. I kind of know how to play the game. Yeah. But like, when I, for every single move, black and white in Lee Chess Studies, I'm writing down the why of every move. And so every single game I play, blitz or over the board, I go to my Lee Chess Study after every one. I look up the point in which I diverged, and then I try to explain, like, I add a little sentence to like, no, this is why, and I don't forget next time, and, you know, or this is a line I'll fit, like, I'll often write as a sideline, I face this in blitz, be ready for it. So like both my games today, my draw and my win, they diverge fairly early, which is typical in blitz. Yeah. And so I had to look up, what do I do in these scenarios? Because like often in blitz, you just start guessing. You're just like, I don't know what, I'm out of book. I'm doing my best.
Yeah.
But I feel like if I do this, if I'm playing like 15 to 25 games a week, and I do that for 3 years, my repertoire files are going to be pretty substantial. And I feel like I will have crossed, I can cross off the my kind of master basic openings, because I will have like played enough to where I will be in a reasonable place. I don't know if that makes sense.
It certainly does. A couple of things I'm hearing there. One is, you're making the coolest chessable course I've ever heard. Every move has a why. Oh my goodness. Like when you get this thing fleshed out, everyone's will be like, I'll definitely buy that Chessable course. So, get ready.
Well, on that, what I do is I will sometimes have like three Ys on the same note. I'll have like, Jordan Van Forest, Chessable Course says, Jordan says X, and I'll put his sentence. I'll just literally copy and paste his sentence into the box. I will put in often, like, if I have other thoughts, I'll say Neil colon, and I'll put it so like Van Forest colon, Neil colon, and then maybe. If something like, like with Lee Chess, there'll be sometimes notes about the openings. I'll throw in some, I think that comes from Wikipedia or wherever that comes from. Like I'll put something there, or sometimes I'll say like Stockfish says this is crushing negative 4.5, So like it's really kind of a conversation I'm having in the Lee Chess notes that's, or if I'm looking at Jakob Ogard has a great Tirache, book on the d4 against d4, and so like I will write in words like his words, so it's really like I've got content from different places, mostly books, some Chessable courses, and also now I've another thing that I've changed is I've recently added a coach. All of that content is fodder for these Y sec notes.
That sounds like something very similar to what I do with my files, where it's like I'll put like this was the course I took this from, because I build my own openings from several sources. I'll say why that author suggests it, and then I'll talk about like in a blitz game why I think I didn't play that line, right? Like what tempted me about the other one to try to remember, like, okay, that's a tempter. Don't do it, right? And then as you get better and more experienced, I can add more layers, like remember later, this weird bishop f1 is coming that makes that move good, and you don't see it right now. So you have to remember that that's on the horizon, augmenting the move. And that's been really fun. Like, I never really liked spending my time on openings until it started getting a little more nuanced. Like, I don't like just memorizing lines for the sake of memorizing. I want to really know, like, what are we building towards? What's the plan? What's coming next?
And do you have each opening have its own study in Lee Chess, or how do you do it?
Yeah, because like my Catalan file alone has like 48 chapters already, and my Caro Kann one has like 40 chapters.
How
So
long
it's
have you
like
been doing this?
each of these openings I've been playing over a year, but some of these chapters are just like my coach will be like, here's a sample game we need to add. So
Got it,
like
got it, got it.
it's lines and then sample games, and then it's new versions of the line. So I'll relabel it. I'll be like, this is what I used to play. Not playing it anymore, so I can go back. I don't delete it. I can see like my journey and go like, okay, why didn't I like that line? Oh, right, this thing happens. I don't like that, so I move to this.
I got
So
it.
I do some stuff like that.
Yeah, so what I'm trying, and I've only been doing this for a couple months, is I'm trying to sometimes I'll lump things together. So like if I with the Queen's Gambit Decline, you can have one file that is the Queen's Gambit and the London, for example. You can put them together because they will transpose. And so I've done that in some cases. Although with the Rui, I don't have like five variants of the Rui. I just have the one file for, I don't have the exchange versus the close versus the open. I keep it all in one file. So different people have different ways. But what I'll tend to do is I'll have one, the first chapter will be all recommendations. That's, and then the other chapters are either my games or model games. So I think that it's unlikely that I think there's only like 64 chapters you can have or something with Lee Chess, but that should be plenty for me.
The problem is I started filling them in a bunch of my studies, so it has me worried. Like I put all of my over the board games in, and I filled like three studies now, and so I'm like, ooh, okay, that was worrisome. So but yeah, I think it's fun. I think that's a great way to do it, is to keep adding in and layering. So it sounds like you are playing, and for you, you're sort of building your opening repertoire through that process of playing blitz games, which seems like a really effective way to do it.
Yeah, I don't, I'm not like I bought a couple lifetime repertoires in different areas, and I'm not going like start to finish. What I'm doing is I'm trying to get a sense like with the quick starter stuff, and then when I face something I don't know, then I go to that section. So I really like their option of like you put in a position and then it says look for your for where in the courses. I use that every day. Almost every day because I don't know where in the course it is. And so I'm really using these courses like encyclopedias, not like a normal book I read. So I use what I need when I need it, and then it makes it manageable.
I think that's such great advice. I think people get overwhelmed by the like, I bought this lifetime repertoire and I'm just clicking the learn button every day and going deeper and deeper. And it's like, I don't think that's even what that author intended, unless you're like a professional. I think it's like, go through the quick starter guide, use the rest as a resource to look at when you face something you don't see.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We have to get back real quick to the lack of commute, because what do you do with your note cards, your flashcards now? Do you like go out to dinner with the wife and you're like, hold on, I got to do some flashcards. Like, what are you doing with them?
Yeah, great question. So in my, so I break up my calculation work into sections. So let's say I give myself 60 minutes. I'm doing 15 minutes of flashcards. So that'll get me through like 50. Typically like maybe 50 puzzle basic slash intermediate low intermediate puzzles. So I'm doing flashcards every day, still doing them. I will do some tactics, and I try to do a few of the strategy ones too. So that to me, like to me, there's a big difference between remembering and retaining versus learning new. So every day I'm trying to like hold on whatever I've learned so I don't forget, and I'm gaining. Because really, if it's a revolving door, it doesn't do you any good. So I look at my strategy and my basic tactics flashcards as my retention project. A huge change for me, and it was kind of eye-opening for me, is I never, with basic tactics, I would always cut myself off after 5 minutes. Because I'm like, look, if I'm not going to find it in 5 minutes, I'm not going to find it, period. That's very different with intermediate tactics. Like it's normal to spend 15 minutes on one. And I really, I wasn't training that way. I actually had to like practice concentrating for 15 minutes straight. That's not an easy thing to do. Like I've never seen a kid at over the board focus for 15 minutes, by the way. So like that's a chance for us to beat them. And so I'm looking at intermediate tactics very differently. And so after I do kind of my warm-up stuff, I'm doing some intermediate tactics where I'm basically saying, look, if it takes me to even 20 minutes, I'm not going to quit till I try to figure this thing out. And so I'll only do a few of those a day. But what I'm also working on, it's not every single day, but it's definitely every week, is visualization exercises. So I have a book on that is just all visualization exercises. And cognitive chess. Now, how far along have you gotten in that?
I'm still in the first part and I really enjoy that part. The second part is so weird. The part where you have to reconstruct the games.
I'm going to skip those. I'm not even going to do them. All right. Skip. My advice is skip that. I don't see the point.
I don't either.
So I'll tell you what I think my point is. The reason I struggle to do like a 6-move tactic or 8-move tactic in that range, let's call it like 4 to 8. Mm-hmm. Is you've got to see 4 moves in, and then you've got to freeze that position in your head, and then you got to like branch it out.
Yep.
That's what you don't have to do that with a 3-move tactic, but you do with a like an 8-move tactic. And I couldn't freeze the position in my head. I couldn't go back to where it was. And that's all visualization problems. And so I think that I have more visualization problems than I have tactic calculation problems, if that makes any sense. So like I do sometimes find it's easier to solve a tactic with my eyes closed because I get confused because I see pieces on the board and it's like, it's easier when the pieces aren't there. You know, I don't forget where they are when I close my eyes. And so like I'm working. The other thing, and Ben Johnson's talked about this with some of his guests, like I think that board visualization, I'll just say this for me, it's very hard. I get that these kids, if they did a lot of chess as a kid, it's just natural. Like I've learned from talking to some coaches and GMs and IMs, like they all look mystified at me if I can't just like talk them through a position without a board in front of me. Like they're like I had a one lesson years ago And I showed my score sheet to my coach. I said, should we get a board out? And he laughed at me. And he's like, no, I can just read the chess. I can just read your notation. I don't know what the happening. I was like, how did that's like magic to me.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm also surprised. I'm almost done. So you finished the first section of the first 100 problems.
No, I'm on like number 50, I think. Let
me see. Okay. So I'm at like 95.
Yeah.
I've got 92% accuracy on this thing, which I'm blown away by.
Yeah.
And frankly, the only reason I think I've gotten better at visualizing this stuff. Like if someone said to me, knight on B2, get it to, you know, G4, I'd be like, yeah, good luck. You know, like in my head, you gotta be kidding me. But that's the kind of stuff you got to learn how to do if you're going to visualize. Yeah. And so, what I believe is if you, that book is great. It starts easy, gets harder and harder. So that's what you want. Mm-hmm. The only ones I've missed is because I kind of like said, forget it. I guessed if I take the time, I think I would be at like 95%, 97% accuracy. Hmm. And so, I think that it's an under discussed topic is how important it is. I know that I listened to some GM saying, if you can't picture a board three moves deep, then there's nothing else you need to work on in chess, because like you can't see a four move tactic if you can't see three moves deep. Yeah. You know, and so I look at that as like a huge upside opportunity for me. The other thing I will say is in the games I've played against 1900 players recently, almost every one of them, I could have had a big advantage if I saw an eight move tactic. Both quit around 5-6 moves.
Yeah.
And I think it's very common to quit around 5-6 moves.
Yeah.
And so like, if you know, it's complicated. I mean, like I'm getting better at figuring that out.
Yeah.
Like when's the critical moment. But like if you can push yourself to look a couple moves deeper than your opponent, then you're going to win your games. And I do think that it's usually enough for a 1900 sub 2000 player to just look four moves deep, but it's not always enough. And so I feel like that's where it will be a difference maker for me when I can do that.
Very interesting, this last thing you said, because I have been fighting against that in myself. I find that long variation equals wrong variation all the time for me. Like it's once I start going too far, I know that things are going wrong. Like for me, I need to be focusing on the 3 to 4 moves. But it's fine. Like I can calculate pretty accurately 8 moves, but the problem is I usually miss a really key response that my opponent has that just destroys that whole bit of calculation I did. And that's where I'm at now, is understanding that it's really going wide and really taking into account the whole board and all the possibilities, rather than zoning into one particular line and only calculating it over and over and trying to find out all the nuances of that. And maybe that's just a where I'm at in my journey thing. Like I'm only like, you know, mid 1700s. Maybe this is something that as I hit like 1800, 1900, I'll have worked out a bit.
Yeah, the branching is the game. Like that's the trick. It's like if it's a purely forced line, you and I could probably both do 10 lines, 10 moves. But but it's often not.
Yeah.
And so like it's the width, it's the branching that's going to separate.
Yeah.
And I mean, even the games I win, almost all of them I could have won faster if I just had like I just need to, for me a big thing is don't have to think for every move in the opening. That gives me the time to like really put in some like 5-10 minute things in critical middle game positions or critical end game positions. So like another problem I had, even with this kid I recently played, I was down a pawn in the end game and Stockfish laughs. He's like, you know, you can hold that. I had a knight, he had a bishop, and like I'm already thinking like, oh, this is not good. I'm if I had a bishop, I'd feel better. But all like right. I think I could have sacked the knight for a pawn, and then like he would have an H pawn with a bishop of the wrong color kind of game. Like I didn't put all that together because I got 2 minutes on my clock,
right?
And my brain's fried because I've been like, and the kid's got 50 minutes on his clock.
This is exactly what happened to me in Vegas. I was up material, And we traded down to that exact position where he had like a bishop that covered the queening square. I didn't quite realize what we were doing there, and I couldn't cover the queening square, and I was not able to convert an obvious win into a win. It was very frustrating.
I feel like with the combination of calculation stuff is some, you asked me, do I use my flashcards? Yeah. So it's warm up. Basically I use the, and the other thing that was funny is I had a copy of my, how to beat your dad at chess flashcards. And I usually will do like, I'll try to get to the club 15 minutes early and I'll just burn through like some flashcards as like a mental warm up to get my brain.
That. Yeah.
The kid that I played that night came over and he was like looking over my shoulder at my cards. And then I just looked at him for a second and just gave him a stack.
He was
doing a stack of cards while I was doing it. It was really cute.
That's cute, but you're giving away your advantage, Neil. What are you doing?
Yeah, I don't mind.
All right, I did have a question about visualization. So you said this thing, you said, it's sometimes easier for me to close my eyes. Mm. When you close your eyes, do you see the board and you're able to move the pieces around?
In my head, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's where our brains work a little different. I don't know if you've heard about this thing with me. When I close my eyes, I see darkness. I can't see.
You were saying anything. David has the same issue, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No. I do. I can see. I mean, I get the point now in the famous scene from Searching for Bobby Fischer where the coach knocks all the pieces over. He's like, let me make it easier for you. That's right. Actually a true thing for me. Like I will, what I'll do with a, intermediate tactic, particularly if I get it wrong, is I will close my eyes and I will see all the pieces moving, kind of like the ceiling scene from Queen's Gambit.
That's amazing.
And I will just keep replaying it in my head multiple times and it's easier for me to see it in my head than to see it when there are pieces in the way looking at the position.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I wish I had that ability. Mine is very different. And I will say this, Neil, that feels like cheating. It's touch move. You cannot move the pieces. I can't move the pieces. You shouldn't be able to move the pieces. So I'm learning. I'm actually working with Aiden at Don't Move Until You See It. And we're sort of working on visualization. What's been fascinating with him is he's done so much research into the different types of visualizers, right? And so some people are like you and they're very visual and they can move the pieces around, and then other people are on that spectrum more like me where they can't do that. And so it's like coming up with, you know, still trying to accomplish the same thing but with different strategies. So it's been very fascinating to try to work on that.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay. So visualization you feel like is a large part, and I'm gonna have to agree. I've spent a lot of time on visualization lately. Let's talk about your study plan switch. So you alluded to this already. One of the things that I was most impressed by you was your thing to be like, I am doing strategy for this amount of time, and if I lose in the opening, oh well, I don't care. And so then you were on end games, and I was like, okay. And then I see you on Twitter going like, I've got a coach now. Now I'm doing openings. And I was like, no, Neil, no, you're ruining your prone program. So I know you said it was time was a big part of it, but why not just take more time and just be like, no, I'm going that much harder on end games and I'll finish that portion earlier. Then I'll move to openings.
Yeah, it's a good question. So the short version, and I know I'm probably the least efficient chess learner in the world, but my theory is there's only so much new content in a topic I can retain in a day. So like, in other words, if I try to do 6 hours of end games, there's no way I retain it. And so like, I think that I can retain whatever, maybe an hour or two per topic per day, best case. Okay. And so if I've got 3 hours, then like I'm best off doing three topics. That's kind of the idea. It's more like that idea of iteration and coming back to things. So I think that 3 hours a day of end games would be counterproductive. It wouldn't be efficient. Whereas if I can do like, typically what I'll do is like, I'll do an hour in the morning during the work week. I'm doing like an hour. My goal is an hour of calculation in the morning. And then after work, like an hour of either openings or end games. And with my blitz game somewhere along the way, I'm doing a little bit of openings with every one of those. Okay. And so it works out where my plan is going to be, and I originally thought maybe around 10 years, it's probably going to be closer to 11. But like, I think at the end of this next tranche, which is about 3 years, I will be pretty good at intermediate tactics. I think I will be pretty good at like having my opening repertoire and having a coach help me during that 3 year time, I think will only strengthen it. And then I think I'll be pretty good at basic end games. And just so everyone knows, my definition of basic is basic means foundational. Basic doesn't mean easy. I think that, I mean, one of the things, I know we're going to talk about this too, is the whole like Kenil McMaster chess dojo fiasco. Oh, yeah. But, you know, I look at it, I've played Masters, you know, here's how I look at it. They're like a JV high school team. They are not Michael Jordan. They are not, you know, the Suns even, you know what I'm saying? Like, they're like, if you put it into perspective, if a 2700 played a 2200, they would crush them.
Yep.
I think people have this wrong mental model of what it is to be a master. It's just this arbitrary number at 2200. And they ain't great. They're just better than us, you know? And so they suck a little less. And so I think that a big part of getting better is not being afraid of your opponents and feeling like you can get there eventually. And so I think that, you know, as long as two things are true, I'm going to keep getting better. One thing is there an area where I have a clear skill gap that I can articulate? And the second question is, do I have a rational plan to close that gap? As long as those two things are true, and I think that's going to be true for like another decade, I think I'm going to keep getting better as long as I don't forget what I've already learned. So like, to me, it's like math. Don't forget what you've learned and have a clear path to close gaps. If my openings right now are Swiss cheese and my endings are Swiss cheese and I'm 1800.
Yeah.
You know, like, it doesn't feel impossible. And to be honest, I don't think about ratings on a daily basis. I think every day about like putting in my time to close gaps, like converting knowledge to skill, gaining new knowledge, gaining new skill. Like, that's my game. Like, I don't have an obsession or even like a quarterly thought about like, where am I going to end up in this process? I'm much more process driven than I am. That's why, in part, why I said like I was surprised at how quickly I jumped up to 1800. Like, I think of 1800 as like a serious player. Yeah, you know, like too. I guess I'm a serious player now.
You are. Know? Yeah, that's been my own cutoff. 1800 to me is like, that's like a real, real good chess player.
Yeah, and what I see at 1800 is, man, I'm full of holes. You know, imagine what I'm going to be like when I close those holes.
Yeah.
You know, and when I see 1900s and 2000s, they have holes, they just have less of them. So it's all about like closing the holes and in your game, like you're leaking points. Be less leaky, and you're going to win more games. And the biggest thing I've noticed recently is if I can get out of the opening with marginal time spent, I got a real shot of like outplaying someone in the middle game. It felt really great. Two games ago, there's a guy who he was a kind of 1900-ish player. He's now more of an 1800-ish player. At the end of the game, he said to me, "You outplayed me in every phase."
Wow. That's
awesome. And I was like, that's so nice to hear. You know, it's so rare you hear that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so like, I just got to be able to do that consistently. And I got to believe I'm going to get better. And I don't really care how good I get. Like, I'm loving the process. I'm loving that I'm closing gaps. And it's so much easier when you don't have kids in the house, man. It's so much easier. It's so much easier when you have a zero commute, you know, like, I feel like I'm like 25 again from a time perspective, you know, and I don't even have to like try to meet a lot of women to get dates. I got a wife. I just like, boom, she's there. We just go out. It's like super efficient. It's awesome. You know? And so like, I feel like I want to put the time in. I know like what was the name of the guy you just recently had on? Maybe your last David, was it? The
lawyer? Yeah, David.
You know, like he's in reinvesting time he was using for his masters. I mean, I think he's putting in more time than I am.
I think he is, yeah.
But like, good for him. Like, and I appreciated his attitude of, it's like, you know, these 12-year-olds are not rocket scientists, you know, like they're beatable. I have beaten plenty of these kids, and it's so fascinating because they often move like in seconds.
Yep.
But they'll make they will often blunder in a second as well.
Yep.
And all you got to do is like tighten the screws on them after they're down, because like what'll happen is it's hard for anyone, but I think particularly when you're not fully emotionally like developed yet as a kid, to like feel like you're down and all your kid friends keep walking past you.
Yeah.
But you think we feel the pressure. They've got to feel the pressure.
Oh yeah. You're losing this old guy. What? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I wonder if the whole master reverence comes from like, you know, the past. Like I know 20 years ago we had a couple 1800s at the club and we were like, they're gods. Like, these guys are basically gods. I've never seen a master. I'll probably never meet one. Like, I don't even know what that person would be like. Like, their chess must be the greatest you could ever imagine. And I don't even remember, and there was that scene in The Queen's Gambit where she tries to sign up for the open section. And they're like,
there's two 1800s. Yeah.
And now we're like, yeah, that's Neil. I wouldn't be that worried if Neil showed up. Like, he's good, but like, people aren't talking about Neil that way.
Well, I won a game. This was years ago. I was low 1700s at the time. I won a game. I was in playing up in the open, and that's part of why I think I was getting my rating was getting beat up a bit, because I've always tried to play as up as I can, like one level above my regular rating. And this was back when there were proper masters, and there was a guy rated I think 2350, maybe higher. So he's a serious guy.
Yeah.
And so I won my first game somehow. And so I'm on board one against this guy.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, I mean, he showed up late. He probably didn't think much of me. And he actually got in trouble.
Ooh.
And I was like, oh, my gosh. Everyone in the club is like coming by the board, which is not helpful, you know, to me, you know. But I ended up not capitalizing. I ended up like in the end game. Tricked me in the end game. I lost. He was kind enough to do a postmortem with me, and he just looked at me and he said, "You're absolutely going to make master without a doubt in my mind."
Wow.
And I was like blown away. I was like, "Wow, that's like the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me."
Yeah.
And so, like, I think that the masters know their games have holes too. They just have smaller holes. And so I think it is in everyone's best interest to demystify the people who are 100 above you. If you're a 1200, then don't be scared of the 1300s. The same process goes all the way up until you get to like 2700, probably.
Wow. It's so funny you said that, because over the weekend, last weekend, my daughter was at this little kids scholastic tournament and she was in the under 400 section and she's like 370 and she found out that the kid she had to play in the last round for first place, his actual rating was like 440, you know, it just wasn't published yet. Yeah. And she was like, "Dad, I cannot beat people in the 400s. They're just too good." And I'm like borderline laughing, but I'm trying to be a good parent. I'm like, it'll be all right. But what you said is so true, right? To her, the 400s are what playing 1900s are for me, which are a little bit worrisome. And that's just her 100 point difference sounds so hilarious. But it's I think that's true all the way up, that 100 points we have to just be like, they're just regular chess players. Like, could you imagine being like, 400s, Neil, they're impossible, like you can't beat them, like, man, they have some serious holes.
Well, I mean, that's exactly how we feel, but like the word master is what messes with people's minds. They could just as well be called, like, you know, slightly suckier players, like, because that's what they are. You know, and how are you on time? I mean, one of the things I've noticed is I'm almost always one of the last players at a board at the end of the game. And I'll tell you why I feel like that's an advantage. What I've noticed is, you know, everyone gets a bit of a reputation, like of some kind, like some of the older guys are like not the best reputation because they tend to drop pieces easily.
Yeah.
But like, I definitely have heard people say like, man, this guy takes forever. You know, meaning like he uses every minute of his clock. And so what I find is kids and sometimes adults, even if I'm like, you know, playing on the worst side, like I'm down a pawn, but it's a holdable position in an end game, they're much more likely to offer me a draw in a worse position, in like when I'm defending, because they're like, I'm not sitting here for another hour. Like, and Neil is willing to. So one of my favorite pieces of advice came from Ben Feingold, and it's the whole play like you never want the game to end. And use all your time. Like, there's no reason not to. I feel like there's a huge mental advantage, because a lot of people, I think part of why they offer draws is because they don't want to sit for 3 hours in a game.
Yeah. I'm in a weird spot where my club only plays game 55s, and I am always the last person. Like, everyone knows Kevin's closing down the club. Like, it takes so long that they've broken down all the tables but the one I'm playing on before finally it's like, all right, you're finally done.
So, do you feel like you have, I mean, to me, 55 would feel really tight. I mean, 90 is tough for me. Like, do you feel like you have the time with 55 minutes?
Not always. 90 is the time control I like best. 55 feels tight. I tried to play a 45 once and it was a total mess. It was like 45 was just too short. 55, I've like calibrated myself where I can just barely get the thinking done that I want to get done. And there's positions where I just kind of go, if this was a game 90, I'd spend 30 minutes here, but I can't do that in game 55.
I'm the same with you. There's a guy, my club president, like in his basement, he has a whole setup, and he'll do game 30. And he invites all these older guys who all they do is like study Dubov trick lines. Yeah. And like, I get crushed every time, because every time they've got a new Dubov trick line, I'm like, dude, like, this isn't chess. Like, come on. Like,
right. Yep. Yep. And if we were playing a game 90, I'd have time to really try to sort this out. But in a game 30, I just can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. All right. Well, it sounds to me like, I mean, we have a couple people asking about burnout. Dr. Fran specifically was asking you if you suffer burnout. And I'm wondering if one of the ways you combat it is this new approach of splitting it into different topics. Do you think that is helping with burnout?
It probably does, because it's more interesting to do three things in one day than one. I would say, you know, it goes back to my attitude about like identity and who I am. And I'm a chess player, and chess players play chess, and chess players study chess. I think that's part of it. I think when you can move things from decisions to habits, it's massive advantage.
Yeah.
Like, people think, just to get the kind of like, you know, morality, I know that that's a topic you've close to your heart. People think moral people and quote unquote good people who make good decisions, they think they just all day long, it's like, bad decision, good decision, I'll pick the good one. No, that's not what they do. What they do is they just have habits of doing good things, and they don't have to think about it, and they just do it. And so, like, you know, if you don't drink two bottles of wine, you're less likely to like then make bad decisions, you know? And so, like, just don't drink the two bottles of wine, you know? And so, like, I think that similarly, if we can move, like, the two mental models I think a lot about is, how do I make everything I want in my life become a habit and not a decision? Like, I walk every day for 3 miles. I don't think about it. I don't worry about what the weather is. I just do my 3 mile walk every day. It's just one of those things I've ticked over to the habit side of the equation. I'm not a good person for doing it. It's just a habit.
Right.
I think I wake up in the morning before work and I do some chess. I don't think about it. After work, I don't like decide, do I want to, do I not? It's not even a choice. I just do it. So like, there's some of that in there. Mm-hmm. I think if I'm having a terrible day or whatever, stuff's going on, I give myself the out of saying, like, you know, if I do 15 minutes, that's fine. And 15 minutes always turns into 30.
Right.
And so like, I think that, but I will say, like, if I do a 30 minute day, the next day I'm like, oh man, I got to put in some, I'm like so juiced and ready to like put in a few hours the next day that it all balances out. I will do more like, I mean, it's not uncommon for me to do more like 4 hours of work on a weekend, cause I just have the time, you know? And so like, I'll sometimes, lean in on the weekends. But yeah, I'm like super interested in learning and getting better. And, you know, I think that it's probably like a 20% you learn and 80% you do to get the skills down, because like, knowing without the doing, the knowing doing gap is a real thing. And so you got to focus more on skills than knowledge. But like, I find this fascinating, and I have a lot of other interests too. Like, I'm reading Thomas Aquinas because I'm working through the greatest books of Western civilization, and like I read lots of workbooks. I'm learning about DevOps, which is something I've never really studied before, but I oversee not only product and customer success, but also the engineering team. So we've had some DevOps issues, so I'm digging into that. I feel like curiosity is a great like cure for burnout.
Gotcha. So you just kind of put it back to like, A, I'm a curious person who likes to learn. B, these are the habits I do. And C, like, I'm a chess player. What do you mean burnout? How can I burn out? I'm a chess player.
Yeah, I don't, like I said, like on my worst day, I do a half hour and I'm like, yeah, I still feel great about that. That's okay. I don't feel like, I never feel bad if I don't put in 2 hours in a day.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's good. I feel a little burnout every now and then, but it's not like I don't want to do chess. Like oftentimes it'll be, like you said, you have a really healthy relationship with ratings right now. I do as well, but there have been times where I haven't had as healthy a relationship, where I lose 150 points over a few months and I'm trying not to focus on it, but it's becoming really harder and harder to double down and put in more time, knowing that, you know, even though I probably will see long-term gains, in the short term it's not happening. But I channel sort of what you say. I kind of like, well, I'm a chess player, so like I could just quit chess if I want and just do other things. But if I'm going to be a chess player, I'm not the kind of guy who wants to go every Wednesday and get crushed by people and be like, yeah, no, I didn't do anything this week. I just showed up and played chess. Like, that's just not who I am.
Yeah. And just the mental model I have might not be right. Is like, I look at it as like, you know, the different elements of chess are like the walls of a house. And if some of the walls are lower than others, then like, you're probably going to play sometimes at the rate, the value of your lowest wall. Yeah. You know, it doesn't mean that like the next week you might like play much better or play much worse. It's like, until all the walls are built, it kind of doesn't matter. Yeah. Like, and when I think about, like, I always hate losing, but like when I lose, it's like, who cares, Neil? It's like one game. It's like, right, this is a lifelong journey, and like, yeah, let it go. And just don't make the same mistake twice is like the best thing the most healthy thing I think I get from losing. And so, yeah, there's a lot of psychology and kind of self-talk. I mean, I had a time recently where I was frustrated with myself about a game that I won, but I missed chances to win faster. and I said to myself, Neil, like, you can't be mad when you win and be mad when you lose, because you'll always be mad. So like, I have to sometimes do that with myself.
That's so real, right? Because it's like, chess is so cruel. Like, you can put your game in the computer and the computer's like, you missed a simple two move tactic, and you're like, well, now I don't even deserve to win. Like, this game's pointless.
Well, and it has frankly helped that I've had a coach recently, which I haven't had for years, and I've shown him some games like, yeah, you know, Stockfish says I missed this, I missed that. He's like, I've never played those moves. The moves you played is the ones I would have played. Like, I think all your moves were sensible. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm better than I thought I was. Like, someone who's better than me thinks my moves were all sensible, you know? So I think that, Stockfish is a cruel mistress. And so like, you've got to have humans like help tamper that down.
Yeah. I love when you're like up minus, like you're up 9, Stockfish is like, you made a mistake, you're only up 3 now. And you're like, but I made the human move that wins. And it's like, yeah, but it's still a bad move. And you're like, shut up.
I'm better at that now. I don't look for the most, like I had a game where I could have like won faster, but like in a real game, in an end game, when I'm low on time, as soon as I see a line that absolutely wins no matter what, I play it. I don't like say, okay, let's stop and let's find a more winning line, because one winning line is not good enough. Like, if I found a mate in 5, I don't look for a mate in 2.
Yep. I agree. Let's talk about coaches for a second. Cause you're like the one guy who's putting in all the time, who never had a coach. And it was always like, well, Neil has a clear plan, he doesn't need a coach. I understand. What made you one day go like, I have this clear plan, I have these holes that I'm intentionally filling, but I think I should have a coach also? What got you there?
I always expected, as part of my multi-year plan, that whenever I got to openings, I would get a coach.
Oh, okay. I know.
And so it was a natural thing for me since I decided to go there. And, you know, I've only done a few lessons. We're going to, you know, I committed to a full all of this year. Cause like once I found someone I felt comfortable with, I was like, I got to give it a year and see what happens.
Okay.
I'm excited because we spend most of our time looking at my games, talking about opportunities in the games. He shows me, model games or fragments and asked me to solve them, but they're all related to the openings I play, and he's never tried to like change. He basically said every opening you play is a GM level opening, so I'm not going to try to change any of your openings. It's not like you're playing junk stuff.
Nice.
I'm not playing the Stafford, let's just say that. And so I really wanted that. I wanted a coach who wasn't going to try to convert me. Like when I get to, if I ever get to 2200, 2300, yeah, I may have to change a few lines. I might try to learn the Nimzo Indian. But like for now, I think this stuff's more than adequate. And he does too. And so, yeah, I'm only doing, one session, 2 hours a month.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not doing weekly because I frankly think 2 hours a month's probably the extra push, you know, that I'm going to need to just work on. And when I say openings, I mean openings and more importantly, kind of related middle game strategies for those particular lines.
Yeah.
It's not trying to get through the first 5 to 10 moves. It's really like, how do you set up those 5 to 10 moves to play the next 20 moves the best way you can?
Yeah, that makes sense. I think it sounds like our coaching situation is very similar then. My coach and I, it's basically I play my game every Wednesday. On Thursday, generally, we go over it. So like Wednesday night, I get back from the game. I put it in. I take about 20 minutes, write down my thoughts. The next morning before work, I try to do another half hour of analysis. And then coach comes in. No engine yet. And
yeah,
then
yeah,
coach
same
and
thing.
I work through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's told me like, don't engine anything like that we're going to talk about. So I've been trying to be better, like to not do that with him. I mean, pre-coach, the engine was my coach, but now
I'm
trying to, and it's helpful to say, like, I played this guy that he was rated close to 2200 at my club before he quit because of the kids. And I could tell I was in a dangerous place because I was on board one with him.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I had a better position, and like people kept walking over, and I kind of like sat up taller and look at how good I am.
Yeah.
And then like I missed a chance for him to pin a piece, and then ultimately like my position crumbled, and I just walked into, like, I was just being lazy about his resources.
Yeah.
And I've got to stay vigilant. So that was a lesson, you know?
Yep. I keep learning that lesson. That's annoying. Okay. Well, we've alluded to this a few times. The Dojo Talks did a little bit about, can any adult make Master? But they decided to use you as the example because I think you're one of the more prominent figures in the Twitter community who's talking about an adult trying to get Master. I'm curious, were you sort of flattered that they chose you and specifically labeled you? And then also, what do you think of their predictions, which were not very generous? I think, what did they say? 1 in 100,000 are your chances? I don't even know what that means.
Yeah. Yeah. I had no idea they were going to do that.
Oh, wow.
I was disappointed that they did. They called it would be like me doing a show, or you and I doing a show. The whole show is Jesse any good as a coach?
Yeah.
Like that's kind of like what they targeted. Now, you know,
and with the conclusion of no, he's not.
Right.
Right. Right. Like that's the kicker.
Yeah. That's the kicker. And so like part of me was thinking like, so I have two, I'm of two minds on this topic. One is, you know, Jesse asked me for advice on books and content for his program that they make money on. This was a while ago, and I did it. And I feel like this is my thank you for that. Like, that's not very, it wasn't a nice thing to do.
No,
honestly, like I've had people like literally my last game minutes before that we're starting the clocks, the president of the club comes over and he said, a lot of people seem to be curious if you're ever going to make Master. And you saw that. And then like, I'm trying to get in a good clear headspace.
Yeah,
and then
right.
my opponent, who's this kid I've never seen before, He asked me what I'm talking about, and I explained it. And he said, "You got to be kidding me! They really did that to you?" He's like, "Do you even know them?" You know, and then oh, the clocks had to start.
Right. Yeah,
that's not helpful.
No,
and so like, there's a part of me that's like, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and it's more like bulletin mm-hmm. board material. You know, I think the one in 1,000 is ridiculous. What I know is I am going to get to 1900, and chances are I'm going to then know that I can get to 2000, you know? And so I'm thinking about this at like, you know, 100 point increments, and like, it'll get to wherever it gets to. But, there's zero chance they would have done it if I had, you know, like 20 followers. The fact that I've got 9,300 followers or more, whatever, is like the only reason they singled me out. Today, you know, like yesterday I got a note about like doing some Chess Dojo tournament thing, and I just responded to Mitch on Twitter saying, "Dude, I'm not feeling the love from these guys lately." And then Kostya, who I could tell during the show was not super cool about singling me out.
Yep.
And he and I have a friendship, you know, he said that, like, "Sorry to hear that." And then Jesse's like trying to do a 180. "Oh, it didn't mean anything." And he's like, "It wasn't personal." And then I showed the clip of, I said, "There's nothing more personal than, can Neil Bruce make master?" That's like the most personal question you could ask. So yeah, I mean, these guys are, you know, they're trying to get clicks. That's, I think, why they use my name versus just like the generic kind of person.
Yeah.
I don't think it was malintent. I wouldn't have done it, but like, whatever. Like, I look at it as, there's all kinds of people who like to tear others down, mm-hmm. and I see no point in it. I tend to try to be a really positive person, and I try to encourage other people in the Chess Punks community to be a positive people. Mm-hmm. And I would never tell somebody, you know, like, something that a lot of other people have done can't be done by you, which is a true statement. Like, one of the guys who was in my club, he went from about our rating, like 1800s, up to National Master in his 50s. And he wrote a book about it, like Master at Any Age. And I ended up getting to play him in, and I lost a game. I won a game. And he signed his book for me. He also used flashcards. And so he was really he's like, "You can do it, Neil, you can do it." So like, I feel like I have people who are like cheering for me, you know, but yeah, so that's kind of some of my thoughts. What was your reaction to it?
Yeah. Since it wasn't about me, I was like, "Oh, this is a great discussion about, you know, whether an adult can get there." I wasn't sure if you would respond with like, "It's kind of flattering that you chose me as your example," or if it's like, "Especially since you're going to say no, and not only no, but like, it's more like you'll get hit by an asteroid or something." Right. That probably didn't feel great. But also, as I was listening to it, I kind of felt like the whole discussion was flawed, right? It was like, we have this data set of people who have played chess and have not reached this goal, but I'm not sure we have a good data set of like people today who seem to be younger for their ages. We've like,
right,
people who are older now seem younger, both physically and mentally, and are really pushing a lot harder. Like when I played 20 years ago, I didn't know anyone in their 40s or 50s who was like, "My goal is master. I study several hours a day." Like, all those people were like, "I played as a scholastic player. I never reached my pinnacle. And now I just ride on and have a great time playing chess." So it feels like most of their data set they're working with aren't actually the data set they need. The data set they need is like, "All right, we need to take a survey. Who in their 40s has put in at least 10 hours a week and tried really hard to make master? And did you make it or not?" Like, that's the data set you should be working from, not just anyone who's ever played chess in their 40s.
Yeah. And I will say this, whether I do it or not, I will make a prediction that it'll be the 4 minute mile game.
Yeah,
people will say the 4 minute mile can't be broken. And then once it was, a whole bunch of people broke it because mentally they realized it could be done. So I think that whether I do it or not is irrelevant. But like, do I think that a bunch of adults who are over 30 whether they played as kids or not is irrelevant to me. A bunch of adults over 30 are going to make National Master, which is not even a FIDE Master. It's, you know, it's JV basketball, man. It's possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that's I think that's a good point. There's the two prongs there. The first prong is that it's Master isn't quite the achievement we once thought it was. Like, it's really good. Let's be clear. I think Masters are very good chess players. But we just have these resources where we can see the top players, their thoughts whenever we want. We have people who are putting in more time, people who are more physically able to do it. I mean, like, that in itself is a challenge. Once you hit 40, 50, if you're not able to take care of yourself physically, it's going to be really hard to do it. So it's like we have this whole group of players, and I totally agree. I think several players in their 40s are going to hit Master.
And, yeah, for sure.
And then it's going to be kind of like, oh, so it can be done. Is it easy? No. You have to, you know, be able to put in the work. You need to be able to find a way to balance all those things in your life, and that is very challenging. But for the people that can pull it off, I just don't think it's impossible. I look at that and I'm like, that seems very doable to me. So I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm trying to achieve that and I'm in my 50s. So I don't know.
I also think there are ways to optimize. Like, you can, it's basically optimal for me to play once a week. It would not be optimal for me to have to play twice a day, 5 days in a row.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
You know, because kids are going to have the energy that I, as a 50-something, am not going to have. And so, like, if I can have the time and the energy to, and it's a long enough time control that, like, I can play a real game, you know? So, like, if it was a 30 minutes, the games, my board, my, there's another club near me. They play, like, 30-minute games. I will never join that club because it's not my thing.
Right. Yeah.
But, like, if you can set yourself up for success, place like less times per day, I'm gonna have to start, unless the demographics, you know, the ratings of my club changes, I'm gonna have to start playing some like more like higher rated people in order to keep growing my rating. I'm not gonna worry about that to like crack 1900, but like I'll probably have to do that, and I will pick tournaments where, you know, maybe I take a few buys, like, you know, like I'm gonna optimize for me. I'm not going to worry about like, did I win the tournament or not? I'm going to try to get good outcomes. So I think that you can do things to help with that.
Yeah. Speaking of optimizing, I would really love, and I don't think I'm going to do this, but just as an example, to start something like the Chess Journeys tournament series. And it's all 21 or older, like kids have their scholastic cycle. So then an adult thing where there's like every week there's some, in a different city, there's one of these Chess Journeys events, and there's a point thing that you go for at the end of the year. Rather than having these giant prizes every weekend, we can have the entry fees be lower. You're playing for trophies. I think it would be fun. Like, adults don't get trophies. It's fun to be able to take something home. Like, if I have the choice between winning $40 and a trophy, I want a trophy. I want to be able to show my family, like, look what I did. I accomplished something. I just think that would be really fun to give adults this sort of, more optimized for them, right? Like, you're not having to deal with all the things that come with playing with kids. I'm not saying I don't like playing with kids. I think it's fun to play with them at the big tournaments, but I think there should be an option. Like, every weekend,
there's a
tournament for
adults. Now, have you been to the Charlotte Aalto event? I want to go there eventually.
I want to. For me, that's like my dream tournament to go to. It sounds so fun.
I've got to get there. I've got to get to, just been a minute on like, dream opportunities. Yeah. Like, I got to get to St. Louis.
Okay.
I want to shake Yasser's hand and buy him a drink. That's like on my bucket list.
Okay.
That's way higher, but like on the list lower down would be Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to play at some point, probably when I'm above 2000, I would love to play an open tournament like a YKNZ or something like that.
Yeah.
Isle of Man, something. Reykjavik. You know, like Reykjavik. Yeah. I want to play. I just want to be in the same room with these people and feel like I'm in it among the elite. You know, I'll probably lose all my games, but that's not secondary.
Yeah, I want to play Faruja as he's trying to get into the candidate cycle.
There you go. I don't even care if it's like, you know how like there's like the real players group and then the
Yep.
second group. I'd be fine playing in the second group,
Yeah.
but I'm like, as long as I'm in the same building and like
Right.
you know, I'm tall, I'm 6'7", I can see everyone. Like no one's like I don't the fake walls and the ropes don't mean anything to me. They're like
Yeah.
grocery stores. I'm in a grocery store. I'm like, oh, it's three aisles over. It's like I can see everything. And so like I think that would be awesome. And it'd be awesome to get to have a conversation with some of these people. And so like that's definitely on my bucket list. I think that you know, probably in about 10 years, I'm gonna retire from work full time and I think I'm going to lean in harder on chess at retirement. Like I'm now leaning in three times as hard as I was, you know, 7 years ago. I think I'll lean even harder in once I retire. It'll give me more chance to travel. And so I don't know. Have you thought about that at all?
I definitely have several tournaments I'd like to go to. I would love to once a quarter just go to some big, cool tournament, especially once I'm retired. I don't know how much funds I'll have. You know, I am a teacher, so maybe I won't have my big tournaments will be like traveling to Arizona. But I'm hoping to do at least like once a year, go to a like that'll be the vacation, right? My vacation
Sure.
is I'm going to Spain. I'm going to play in this tournament, and then I'm going to bookend it with a couple days to really enjoy Spain.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that I think would be an awesome bucket list thing would be to do one of these like 5 day training sessions that like Jakob Arga
Oh, yeah.
does. You know, he does them in some cool locations, at least in the past he has. And you know, I know I'm going to be with a bunch of 10-year-olds, but and I know that they're going to crush me in these positions that these killer tactics training things that he does, but it doesn't matter. Like just to kind of be among people who are obsessed with chess in a good way and trying to get better. I just think that it's a wonder it would be a wonderful experience.
Okay. I'm gonna ask you something that's gonna, I think, might anger you.
Yeah.
So you said you have all these followers on Twitter. You know, the Chess Dojo clearly recognizes that people are following you and your journey. So
Yeah.
I just said the other day to you, I was like, hey, we can talk about you as a role model. And you were like, role model? I'm not a role model. So I want to hear about this. How can you claim you're not a role model? I feel like you are the role model for thousands of adults who are trying to put together a study program on their own and find success, like the great Neil Bruce. What do you think? Are you a role model or not?
I've never thought of myself as a role model, and I think there's got to be way better ways to get better at chess than me kind of groping in the dark trying to figure it out. I do think that within 5 years, we'll all look back and say, "Man, like someone has got a plan that's like master in 5 years." I mean, I'm serious. I think that people will be able to get from like 1100 1000 to master in like 5 years once they've kind of figured out how to do it. None of us have that path. We're all kind of groping in the dark right now. And I definitely feel like I'm groping in the dark. Like when I started saying I'm gonna get serious about chess, I thought, okay, an hour 1 year on tactics, 1 year on endings, 1 year on openings, 4 year game, boom, I'll be good. And then I realized chess is a lot harder than I thought it was. And so you know, all I'm trying to do is share what I'm going through, encourage others, like be a positive participant in this chess community, and you know, help people understand that you can learn new things. I feel like so many adults are sheep and they shut their brains off at 25 and then they just wait for the dirt nap. And so I think that it's wonderful to challenge yourself and to get out of the comfort zone. You know, I think of there's three zones: is the comfort zone, the training zone, and the danger zone. Whenever I buy like when I bought Dvorsky's Endgame, I was in the danger zone. You know, like but like as long as I could stay in the middle, as long as all of us can kind of learn and grow as humans for our entire lives, like. Chess is one mechanism to do that. That's living. I feel like I'm alive and I'm living. And I'm not trying to tell people what to do. I try very hard to say, this is what I am doing. It's one way. And I hope people find better ways than I've done it. But yeah, that's how I feel. I don't feel mad at all about the question, but I don't, I kind of laugh when I hear the question.
Gotcha. I think for me, when I think of Neil as the role model, it's more just the basics of, I'm a chess player, so what I do is I study chess. Like, to me, that's the role model. I have quoted you to myself many times on a day where I was like, it's been a tough day. Like, I'm tired. I had this long commute. I'm not really up for chess. And then this is what I've done lately is I'm like, well, guess what? This happens in chess games, right? I'm in hour five. My brain is mush. And I'll bust out a hard calculation puzzle and face palm it. But like, really try to push my brain to be like, hey, brain, I know you're tired, but we're still going hard. Like, we're not even doing easy stuff right now. We're doing the hard stuff, and you're going to learn to get used to it. So yeah, I feel like that's been the biggest role model for me personally, is just seeing you always consistently doing the habit. And I think other people take other pieces of you as their role model.
Well, thank you very much. It's cool to hear that. I mean, I think that, you know, showing up is a lot of the battle, as has been said. And I think that there's a tipping point between, I want to get better at chess and I'm fairly inconsistent and I'm frustrated, to, you know, it's going to happen every day. It doesn't matter if it's 5 minutes or 5 hours. I'm going to work this problem. And I guarantee, for anyone listening, if you figure out something that you have a gap in, skill gap in chess, and you work with somebody to help you come up with a plan to close it, you will close it. And it's just about how many holes you can close. You know, that's really what, to me, chess improvement's about.
Yep. I like that. I've got a question that's just a little off topic. We're nearing the end of this conversation, but you helped spearhead this Chess Punks tournament. What was that, over the summer?
It was fall. Yeah.
Fall. Okay. And I'm just curious, like, how did you put it together? You know, what do you think went well about it? And what are some things that you're, as you reflect, that you would like to do differently next time? Because first of all, it's a pretty amazing achievement. You got chess.com to like acknowledge our community, to give prizes out based on our community. Like, it was a really cool, awesome achievement.
Yeah. So I reached out to Danny, chief chess officer at chess.com, literally just sent him, because I'm not in his DMs. Like, I just sent him a tweet. I just at Danny Wrench. And he said, I'm in.
Oh,
I knew he knew. So for years, I've been thinking it would be awesome to have like a proper Chess Punks tournament.
Yeah.
And I was basically waiting until I felt like enough people, like, I'm good friends with Gert. So like, but he's not Danny,
right?
You know, and Danny can say we're spending 10 grand on prizes,
right.
And so, I knew, I was watching him do an analysis one time, Danny, on a show, chess.com show, when he said, you know, for all you chess punks out there, here's, you know, I was like, oh my gosh. Like, so like, it was clear to me that he was into it. I mean, we're clearly also like the people who have the cash to spend a lot of money on chess.com and Chessable. Sure. So like, we're his target audience. So it's win-win. But so I reached out to him. He said, Gert, why don't you run with this? So Gert and I actually did all the logistics together, series of meetings to pull it off. I think it was a great tournament. I'm so psyched. I mean, like, having all these coaches come for free to like, and then like the whole event day, it was just an amazing experience. What I'm looking to do with the Chess Punks, so I'll broaden your question to like, what's going on with the Chess Punks. So like, I'm going to be acquiring the URLs to chesspunks.com, chesspunks.org. I know who has them. So like, I'm going to be able to create a site. I've created a YouTube channel, but I haven't put any content on it yet. I'm going to create a Twitch channel where we can like record content and then put it on the YouTube. I'm looking at basically doing something every quarter. So like, I'm thinking we could do a kind of training symposium, kind of like lecture series in the spring. In the summer is the awards show. In the fall can be the annual chess.com sponsored tournament, and then we'll figure out something for the winter. But like, I think it would be awesome to eventually have like every quarter have like a big event associated with the Chess Punks. And like, it has if someone said to me when I sent that first email out to Stacia encouraging her for like breaking 1800, you know, like if someone said, oh, like Danny Wrench is going to offer to give $10,000 in prizes to you guys, like I was blown away. So like I couldn't be prouder of the Chess Punks community. And I feel like it still has legs. The thing I think about is like, how do we take it to the next level? How do we keep it interesting and engaging? Mm-hmm. And if anyone out there has suggestions for how we take the Chess Punks to the next level, I'm all ears.
Nice. I think the thing I've been most impressed by with the Chess Punks is that normally as internet communities get bigger, they get worse. That's just been my experience. They become more negative. They become more toxic. They start to emulate the internet as a whole. And the Chess Punks community, as it's grown, has continued to grow just to be a positive place where people are kind and supportive of one another. And it's just kind of a remarkable community. It's the only internet community that I consider myself to be like a full member of. It's the only one that I've ever felt like this actually brings like true pluses to my life. All the other ones are kind of like, I get some good knowledge I needed, and then I've got this person randomly saying terrible things to me for no reason at all, who's never met me. I don't even know what's happening right now. The Chess Punks is not like that. So congratulations to you and all the other founders of it. It's been pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's a testament to there's a craving for a safe place to come together and support each other. And I think it's really rewarding. I think that it's things like that, like the Chess Punks community, that is going to propel people to strive for greater and greater heights, whether it's learning better chess or studying better chess or higher ratings, whatever it is for the person. I also think that one thing that we did that I'm really psyched we did was this whole idea of an honorary Chess Punk. I mean, I never thought Susan Polgar would be like regularly engaging with Chess Punks and telling Omar, oh, you know, your queen goes here, you know, like that's insane to me. And that like, I have regular Twitter conversations with Jakob Augard is like insane to me.
Yeah.
It's like, I literally feel like I've got a handful of GMs and IMs kind of at my fingertips if I ever wanted to like annoy them with a question, which is crazy and awesome. And I'm so grateful for that. So like, I'm glad that we decided to go with an honorary Chess Punk award, because there are a lot of people who are, already titled professional players, never were or will be like official members of Chess Punk, but they are huge contributors to the benefits, and I want them to feel recognized for that. So like that's been really cool.
Yeah, I agree. That was a really smart move. And you're right, there are so many of these amazing players that are so like, they seem to be genuinely supportive, not just like, I'm gonna try to grow my brand and interact with these poor fools. But like really seem to be like, I'm encouraged by your journey and I'm rooting for you. Like, it's just really amazing.
Yeah. I mean, Susan said like she wouldn't have like been engaged in the way she is if it wasn't for the Chess Punks community. Like, she's specifically doing it in response to that. And that's like blows me away. She's one of the best players of all time, you know? So like, it's been awesome. And this has been a great conversation, Kevin. It's always a pleasure to hang out with you.
Yeah. As we wrap up here, I have one question to take us out on. You've been working on end games. Do you have like a sneak peek of two of the end game books that you think have been the best that you've worked with so far?
Well, I just finished Shereshevsky's, expanded version. Now, did you, ooh, you read the green cover, right? You read the big one or the little one?
I read the little one. I read the little
one. I recommend the big one. Now, here's what I would say is if you have, I had both. Like I had the little one for years. I never read it. And then like when it was time, I decided to like check out the new one. Mm-hmm. Here are the benefits of the new one. It's computer check, so there's no messing around.
That's the errors though, Neil. It's great.
Okay. So like you won't like the new one then. It's error checked.
Yep.
It's got modern games. So it's got like Magnus games and a lot of good recent games. And it's got a few extra chapters that I think are really interesting. And so if you have neither, I would go with the green new edition. If you have the skinnier one and you don't want to spend the money, then you get a lot of the value out of the older one. But yeah, so like the newer one is, it's quite a bit bigger. I don't know if you've seen the new one.
It feels like it's almost twice as big.
Yeah, it's close to that. So I just finished that like 2 days ago.
Hmm.
And I honestly said like on Twitter, like it's going to make my short list of like what will propel. So this is worth like a little, like, let's have a quick conversation. So in Ben Johnson's book, he said, focus on technical end games more than kind of practical end games, because maybe they're easier to learn. You know, yeah. I don't know that I totally agree with that. Yes, you have to know how to mate with a king and a rook. And yes, you need to understand a pawn versus king and pawn. Like those things you have to know. Yeah. But like if I was going to give advice, I'd say do Silman up to like 1600, Silman's endgame up to 1600, then stop, then read Sharashevsky, and then keep going. Because most endgames I find over the board are practical endgame problems. They're not like, do I remember Lucina or not?
Yep.
So what's totally your take on like the value of strategic versus technical endgames?
My conclusion is exactly the same as yours, that and that's what I did. Like I got like halfway through Silman and I was like, here's the cool thing. If we stumble into one of these things, I'm in business. But when I get to 90% of my end games, I am so lost. All I know is one thing: the king is better in the center. And I just aimlessly march the king to the center. And then when he gets there, I look around and go, okay, I guess I should start pushing some pawns or something. And after reading Sharashevsky, whether I make the right decision or not, I am very aware of different plans I can enact, you know, what pawn structures are better in endgames versus others. Like it just fundamentally changed how I play endgames and thus fundamentally changed how I play chess. Because before that, I was terrified of weird endgames. And I would be like, no, I don't want to trade pieces off, because then I'm in like this, we each have a rook and a bunch of pawns and I'm so lost, I don't even know how to stand. Whereas after reading it, I was very confident, being like, okay, let's do it. Let's go into this endgame with a bunch of pawns on the board and my rook, and I've got a plan. What's your plan? Do you even have a plan? My guess is you don't.
Yeah. I mean, to me, three things in that book are transformative. One is the schematic thinking, the like, where do you want your pieces to be and how do you get to that point? So that schematic thinking is breakthrough. The whole idea of two weaknesses is a breakthrough way to think. Like often if you only have one, it's not enough. And do not hurry. You know,
that's
like
the hardest one.
That is. And frankly, you got to have enough time left on your clock to not hurry. But like, I think that it is, I wrote down on Twitter, like it lived up to the hype. Most chess books do not live up to their hype. This is an exception. It definitely does. It's one of those kind of anchor books that will transform the way you think. And so actually the next thing I am going to do is I'm going to go back to Silman and I'm going to finish it. I don't know if you finished it yet.
Nope.
So I'm going to finish it, because I've gotten up through the 1800. Okay. So I'm just going to do a review up to 18. It'll be pretty quick. And then I'm going to do 18 to 22.
Okay.
And so I'll finish that book. And then I'm going to actually also bought the chessable version, because it's not enough to know stuff. You got to do stuff. Yeah. And so I want to practice those Silman positions, those theoretical end games. Like I don't even really know the Vankura, but like I know like it's like in the, I think the 18 to 2000 section, you know, like there are openings, or sorry, there are end game technical end games that I'm excited to practice on a regular basis. So that will be what I do for probably the next 3-4 months on the from an end game perspective.
I'm kind of tempted to get the new end game strategy by Sharashevsky and do your method, because you've been posting some of the puzzles and I can't solve any of them. And I'm like, what? I read this book and I can't do anything. And I'm feeling like that is a book that what I took from it was some really general knowledge of like how to begin playing endgames. And I think now another trek through it, making flashcards of some important positions, that I'm turning that general knowledge into actual skill might be really, really beneficial.
Oh, I agree. I mean, one of the things I did, and so that I could review it, is I created a Lee Chess study. of Endgames, and it was all Shereshevsky's positions that I found the most interesting. I also, on the book itself, I think I ended up with 30 out of the 350 pages. There were 30, each one they call a game, even though they're often game fragments.
Yeah.
I wrote down like 20 on the front cover, and then I ran out of space, and then I wrote 10 more on the back cover of the, to be the most valuable positions out of that book.
Okay.
And I put most of them into as Lee Chess studies, so I can also review them that way.
Nice.
But it's not enough to read a book. You're absolutely right. You got to review it, and you've got to try to like get your hands on pieces. I also played through every position on a board. I don't know if you did that.
I did that, yeah.
Good. Well done.
Yeah, I think that's the part of my own process that I'm missing is I read a lot of books, and I don't think I could tell you what most of them said. And that's where I'm kind of jealous of your process, where you made flashcards of really important moments. So it's almost like you're constantly rereading the most important moments of a book. Mm. You've gotten the gist of it, and now you're drilling the most important moments over a period of time. And I might, what I might do is just make boxes for each book and kind of be like, I feel like I've forgotten a lot from this one book. Let's just do the flashcards. Okay. I've kind of like reread that book in a much shorter method. I don't know if you think that would be a reasonable approach.
I think it totally makes sense. I mean, like there's a book by a famous guy named Adler who wrote it. The book's called How to Read a Book.
Ah,
okay. And in that he says, you have to read a book three times. The first time, I mean, if it's a great book, if it's like, you know, Ulysses or the Aeneid or, you know, something of substance. I would put chess books in the same category, good chess books. You read it the first time to kind of get a sense of it. You read it the second time to really try to understand what they're trying to say. And the third time it's like, okay, it's about application. It's about like converting it to skill. And so like I have read Silman up to 1800 at least two or three times, but like I want to go through it again. It's like that Endgame book, it's not a once and done kind of thing. And even like I'm happy about what Chessable can do is like, it makes it automated, you know, like I don't have to plug them all in. They already have the positions plugged in for me. It saves me all that time.
Yep.
And, you know, I can afford, you know, whatever, 30, 40 bucks to like buy that course. And so, yeah, I think that it's way more important. I'm probably only going to read like six chess books this year. It doesn't matter how many you read. It matters how many you retain. And how many you convert into skill.
I agree. I kind of think I might not read anymore. I might just go back through the ones I've read and try to, the ones that I think were worth it, and try to turn that into skill.
Good. That's an awesome plan, man.
Wow, Neil. This has been the longest podcast in a long time for the Chess Journeys, and it was well worth it. So we'll have to catch up in another 19 months, Neil, and see where you're at. Maybe Master. Who knows?
Well, if I'm at 1900, I'll be super psyched.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Neil. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. What's your Twitter handle again where people can reach you?
It's Neil Bruce BC, because I had to get a Twitter account when I was at Boston College taking a course. So I chose Neil Bruce BC.
Okay. Neil Bruce BC it is. If you want to talk to the ultimate chess punk, give him a ring on Twitter. And for all of you out there, I hope this is the week where you gain all your rating points and everything's wonderful. And if it's not, don't worry, we'll have another guest on next week who will help you continue on your journey. And I'll see you next time, everybody. Goodbye.